why do bad things happen, and the perils of explanation. I haven't had such an appropriate setup for a sermon since, and this is an absolutely true story, 1970, I had a sermon, it being Berkeley, at the 1970 technically being the last year of the 60s, and the title was, Don't Be Afraid to Touch. And I came into my church, Star King Unitarian Universalist Church in Hayward, covered with poison oak. All right, sometimes you should be afraid to touch. Kind of got in the way of the message. So I'm driving here this morning, thinking about why bad things happen, and I'm parked on the 405, and I figure, that's okay. I call my wife and say, hey, honey, I'm parked on the 405. Check the computer, see if I'm going to make it. She checked the computer and said, no problem. And then I was parked on the 5. And she was already at the gym rehabbing her knee, and so there was no computer to check with, and I called up Marley's, who I knew was the associate, and said, be prepared to do the sermon. Why opportunities happen to associates when they are actually ready with something to say on the subject. Why? Why is one of the great fundamental questions of humanity. We want to know why bad things happen to good people. We want to know why good things happen to bad people. We want to know why things fall down when you drop them, why things break. We want to know how the earth turns. We want to know what's going on in the skies and the stars, in our bodies. It is human to want to know. And to find patterns and to find explanations, it's part of what makes humanity in our best ways possible. We also make up answers so that when our children may want to know why bad things happen, we come up with an answer that is suitable for a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old. Since I'm going to be involved in at least 3 memorial services today, some of the explanations that we give about suffering and death are well-meaning and usually, in my view, pretty silly theologically. We tell people, well, I'm sorry for your loss, but God needed this person more than you did. Now, the theology of that is horrifying to me, but the human motive of wanting to give comfort is commendable in our nature. So we want to come up with answers. Some of them make logical sense. Some of them are poetry. Some of them are silly. But it is one of the deep needs that we have when we look at the world and what appears to be, and I'm actually willing to stipulate to it, unjust fate. We want there to be a reason. We want there to be order. The idea of randomness and chaos is very difficult for us to accept. We'd like somebody to be in charge or something to be responsible, something that we could fix, some force that we could propitiate through our sacrifices. Some way of not being totally helpless. And so we look at bad things in our literature and our religion, and there's often, though not always, an explanation. In Western religion, the kind of ultimate Platonic form of the non-answer to why bad things happen to good people is the story of Job. The story of Job is the story of somebody who, in fact, does not have the patience of Job. The only people who believe in the patience of Job are those who didn't have the patience to read the whole book of the story of Job. Job is a good guy. He's playing by the rules, and he seems clearly to have been rewarded for playing by the rules, for being faithful. He's well respected in his community. He's got lots of friends, and then something terrible happens, and he starts losing his family. He starts losing his flocks and his fields, and his life really turns into misery in terms of those things out there that he lost and things in here that he lost. He's getting boils. He's getting stomach trouble. I'm sure that there's probably an emotional diagnosis in there somewhere, but they didn't have the diagnostic manual for it at the time. But he is suffering. And his friends are steadfast. They stick with him because they know he's a good man. He's a righteous man. But as his misery increases and remains, his friends start slipping away. His friends start analyzing why it is that Job is suffering. And here's the syllogism that they go through, and it's one that's almost universal. You know, we thought Job was a good guy. God was rewarding him. And that confirmed our feelings. But, you know, he's suffering now. And since we know that God is just, then suffering must be just. Therefore, Job could not be as good as we thought he was, because God would not be punishing him unless there's something that we don't know about Job. So their choice was either God is not being just, or God is not all-powerful, or there's something we don't know about Job. And so they explained Job's suffering by saying he deserved it. At the end of the story, when Job finally gets sick of this and runs out of patience, and he calls God on the carpet and says, God, what are you doing? What were you thinking? I played by the rules. I was good. Why did I lose my family? Why did I lose everything? Why am I sitting here friendless and miserable with open sores? What in the world were you thinking, God? God's answer is very interesting. And it basically says, who are you to question me? Where were you when I created everything out of the whirlpool? Whirlwind, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do an ad for a washer dryer. Where were you when I created everything out of the whirlwind? And which is not much of an answer. But he doesn't punish Job for yelling at him, for calling him on the carpet, for saying, are you sure you know what you're doing? What God does do is rebuke Job's friends for having given a meaning and a purpose to that suffering. His friends did not know the story. They did not know the story about God's gambling problem, that God had made a bet with Satan in order to see if Job would be faithful. And so the friends analyzed Job and blamed the suffering on him. And God said, that's not okay. Now, obviously, as a Unitarian Universalist minister, I'm not asking you to take this story literally. I'm asking you to take it seriously as revealing a truth about how we see suffering in the world. And whether we see it as earned, as just, as something that they brought on themselves. That we look for a cosmic explanation. When bad things happen, we tend to try to explain them. We tend to try to explain them and find some reason, and this is true of all societies, not simply the Western societies. So that when there are hurricanes in Florida, we know it's because there were gay people in South Beach. When there's a tsunami across the South Pacific, we know it's because a couple of Muslims were celebrating Christmas. We put these theological explanations onto the world, And it's so dangerous to end up blaming the victim and victimizing them a second time. We look in India at the untouchables. The untouchables who are untouchable and having miserable lives because of something from a previous life. It is blaming the victim again. Now, I'm going to do an accent, and I have the express written consent to do this, because one of my favorite moments in a movie, because I think it was a universal moment, was in Bend It Like Beckham, where the Indian mother who cannot control her daughter, who wants her daughter home making samosas and she's out playing soccer, says, "Oh my God, what did I do in a past life to deserve this?" And I saw this in Encino, and every Jewish mother in the place went, "Ah!" Never mind the past life part. It was, "Oy, what did I do to deserve this?" It's a universal cri de coeur, this reaching out of, there must be some reason that these terrible things are happening. But we can't explain why bad things happen. They do. That's part of the wonder of life and the wonder of the universe. The danger is when we create a purpose and want to justify it theologically as well as logically. When bad things happen to people, to a society, there's got to be somebody to blame. Maybe it's God. God's just in a bad mood and needs some kind of sacrifice to propitiate his, usually his, irrational desires. And so we, at one time, human beings sacrificed people. And then after Abraham was ordered to take Isaac up to the mountain and a ram was substituted, then it was okay to substitute rams. And then lambs and goats, and there were sin offerings and burnt offerings and flesh offerings, all of which were to propitiate an angry God. We all have to have some reason that it happens. Angry God? Maybe it's somebody else out there. You know, maybe the reason that there are problems in the world, immigrants. Yeah, that's it. It's not the gays in South Beach. It's immigrants. It's Mexicans. And before that, maybe it was Irish and maybe Polish and maybe Jews and maybe gypsies. There's got to be some group out there that is responsible for all of the bad things that happen in my world and my society. Because if it's not God, and if it's not them, and the important thing to remember when you start giving explanations for suffering is that anyone, any group, any gender, any political persuasion, any tribe, any ethnicity can be the great them of the moment. If it's not them, it could be me. And that's actually kind of attractive. There's a wonderful passage in T.S. Eliot's The Cocktail Party where a person comes up and says, "You know, I'd like to think that there's something wrong with me. Because if there isn't, then there's something wrong with the world. And that would be much worse. That would be terrible. So I'd rather think that there's something wrong with me that could be set aright." Well, I kind of understand that. I understand that I want reasons. I understand that I want to have ways of propitiating an irrational, amoral universe. I would love it if I could just, as in the Muslim and Christian and Jewish tradition, symbolically or physically take a lamb or a ram to bear away my sins, to cut its throat, to barbecue it, and have all of everybody's pain and problem go away. That's actually the root of the word tragedy. Tragogia is the story of the scapegoat. Gogia in Hebrew being goat. The scapegoat, where the sins of the community are tied onto the goat, and then it is actually doesn't get to escape. It's pushed over a cliff, and it is sacrificed. And so we sacrifice animals to carry away our own sins. Not sure that that works that well, but it is kind of interesting, this relationship that we have between our sins and our animals. Most societies, in one way or another, do pick these animals to sacrifice, and I probably don't have anybody in here of the right age and background to know what I'm doing. Anybody know what this is? That's very good. Where is Rose when I need her? It's called Shlugan Kapurus, which is the idea that you would take a rooster and spin it over your head, and it would figuratively carry your sins away. I never found that my sins flew away, usually the rooster was scared, had to be alive, and was scared enough that you got a lot of good luck. If you know what I mean, which I suspect you do. The Bible's really interesting in terms of animal sacrifice, because sacrifice is about something of value. It's not about nothing. And so when you are sacrificing lambs or rams, The prime symbol of Christianity is Jesus' Agnus Dei as the Lamb of God. You're sacrificing something of worth, not something valueless. One of the things that our traditions try to teach us about our relationship with life and with our animals, with our pets, is that we do have a relationship and a responsibility. That they teach us how to be compassionate. They teach us that they have value. The whole structure of the kosher rules within Judaism are based on a very generous reading of a tiny little passage that says, do not boil the kid in the milk of its mother. And so from that you get people who don't have meat and milk in the same meal, in the same plate, in the same kitchen, in the same refrigerator, in the same dishwasher. My wife has at least 9 sets of dishes, and she's not kosher. But just, you know, just like everybody else, she picks and chooses the parts that she wants to do. Hers was acquire the porcelain as opposed to actually follow the ritual and the tradition. So which means that in a community property state, I have 4.5 sets of dishes because of the kind of misunderstanding of what that meant. What it meant was animals have feelings. Animals have rights. Even an animal, you wouldn't do the horrible thing of taking the baby and boiling it in the milk of its mother. It's not about dietary laws. It's not about meat and milk. It's about cruelty. It's about irony. It's about the perception that animals actually have not only feelings, but rights, and therefore we have duties towards them. All of you have seen studies that show that older people live longer and healthier when they have pets. I have had dogs, had a couple of really crazy dogs, had a dog that was a vegetarian. I don't know whether it was a principled moral decision that it got from some past life when it had eaten much too much meat, but it was a pretty crazy dachshund, I'll tell you that. Had another dog that was not supposed to be a water dog, but every time I jumped in the pool, he swam laps with me. I had a water dog that wouldn't go near the pool, you know. I do have fish, and every time I walk into my office, I smile, I look at my fish, my blood pressure goes down, and something happens. We had at one time four cats, and I'm allergic to cats, but it was part of my wife's dowry. You know, these are just the things that you put up with each other. And what pets do is they teach not the children who promise to take care of them, but the adults a sense of responsibility, a sense of caring, a sense of relationship. I am hierarchical. If there's a fire, I save my grandchildren before I save my pets. Now, I know not everybody agrees with that, but you don't know my grandchildren. And I think that the issue of hierarchy, for me, is fine. If we don't love and connect to those who are most like ourselves, as a start, how do we reach out further and further to people who are more different, who have differences? How do we make connections if we don't start those connections closer to home in family and tribe, and then reach out beyond our own ethnicity? There's a relationship that develops, that feeds and opens us up when we learn to give, to care, to give love, to receive love, to understand that there are loving relationships that go beyond our own species. That we are part, really, as Unitarian Universalists, of an interdependent web of all being and of all existence. You must wonder why bad things happen. Why bad things happen to good pets, good animals, good people. Why is some animal chosen for sacrifice and another becomes a pet? Why is one left in a cage and another is adopted? Are there things that are intrinsic? Are there things that are divine? Are there things that are just random and we do what we can do to do the right thing at the time that we are given a choice? I come down on that last point. I can't do past that which I can do. And why is one chosen and not another? Why at this service that I'm going to do later today did two parents die 2 weeks apart? Why did Ruth Ellen die one day short of her 60th birthday when she had so much more to give and to experience? I have to cry out all of the whys. There's nothing impious or unfaithful about the cry. It only becomes dangerous when we answer it. It only becomes dangerous when we explain that it was your fault or God's fault or fate's fault, that it was somehow earned, that there must be justice. No, there mustn't be justice. We must do justice, not assume it. And that's the challenge. Don't look for life to be fair. Don't look for the good to flourish and the bad to be punished. Instead, make life fair. Be responsible. Do the right thing at the moment that increases our connection to life, to each other, into our own best selves.